Hello and welcome back to Mars the Word, the Global Health Podcast, where you're joined by Umair and Nuzha. So just to start, I'll introduce myself. My name is Umair, I'm a fourth year medical student and I'm currently intercalating in management. Here with me today is Nuzha.
Hi everyone, my name's Nuzha. I'm a final year at UCL studying History and Philosophy of Science, which is based at the Science and Technology Studies Department. And we're joined by Anat today. If you actually want to introduce yourselves for us all, so the audience can get to know you.
Thanks very much, Umair and Nuzha. So my name is Anant. I am a researcher based out of the University of Oxford and the Heidelberg Institute for Global Health. My background is quite eclectic, if you will. I was born and raised in the States, and professionally, I started off as a molecular immunologist, studying epigenetics and gene regulation in B and T cells. I did that for about 10 years, and after I finished my PhD, I moved to Oxford in 2009 to study medicine with the idea of becoming an academic clinician. And I did 2 years of medicine on the graduate entry program and realized that it really wasn't for me. I left the program after 2 years, and then I joined the England Department of Health in the Right Care program. And the premise behind the Right Care program, or at least the impetus for it, stemmed from the 2008 global financial collapse. So after the 2008 global financial collapse, David Nicholson, who was the then chief executive of the English NHS, issued the Nicholson Challenge, which was to achieve £20 billion in efficiency savings by 2014. And he started this program called QIPP, Q-I-P-P, Quality, Innovation, Productivity, and Prevention. And there were multiple substreams of work within that program. And, you know, something on long-term conditions, type 2 diabetes, mental health, etc. And the program, as mentioned, that I was working in was called Right Care. And the drive for Right Care was basically to see, okay, we have to cut £20 billion, but how do we ensure that where we're cutting from does not negatively impact the health outcomes of people using NHS services? So I did that formally for about 3 years, and then we took some of the learnings that we had from the Right Care program and started a company called Better Value Healthcare. And Better Value Healthcare was a boutique advisory firm working with governments and healthcare providers to help them redesign their healthcare systems to focus on value-based healthcare, which I'll discuss maybe a little bit further down, during the podcast. And we worked internationally, mostly in the UK and in Europe, and we got some of our ideas implemented within Wales and Scotland and also adopted by the EU Commission. In 2019, early 2019, I exited the company and then started working full-time research and teaching. And my primary area of focus has been social determinants of health. Because as you guys know, and many of the audience members will know, and which I think is the basis of Mars the Word as well as an organization, is that if you look at health outcomes, only 20% of health outcomes are due to access to clinical care, whereas 80% of health outcomes are due to these social determinants. So things like access to nutrition and water and sanitation and hygiene and housing and transport and jobs. And that has been my focus since 2019. And I think this has become even more relevant during the COVID pandemic. The main modalities of intervention I look at within social determinants are looking at how technology can be used to address social determinants and also support our responses for addressing social determinants, as well as looking at organizational mechanisms and contract mechanisms to actually improve efficiency of services delivered in these areas, and then also to more formally incorporate these services into care pathways.
That sounds amazing. So like you said, you have a very extensive experience in research, and you mentioned in particular about value-based healthcare. I think it'd be really interesting to go into that, especially because when we define social determinants and like figuring out resolutions for them, it's based on a lot of what we consider. It's not neutral. They're not neutral statements that we make. They're morally loaded in some regards or politically loaded. So what do you interpret as value-based healthcare?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question and observation, Nuzha. So we had some of these discussions very early on, and it's really interesting, but there's a 1S difference that we kind of point out when thinking about value. So we have value without the S, and then we have values with an S. So I think values with an S is the moral ethical dimension that you've described, and value without the S is the more technical definition that we use and is kind of derived from the manufacturing and corporate sector, where a very basic definition of value is outcomes over cost. And that was then kind of adopted by healthcare systems, first by a healthcare economist called David Stonabedian, who was based at the University of Michigan, in some of the work that he did on quality in healthcare systems, and then popularized by Michael Porter, who is a professor at Harvard Business School, who wrote a New England Journal of Medicine article on value in healthcare, where he riffed off of the corporate sector definition and replaced outcomes with patient outcomes. So the definition of value in healthcare then became patient outcomes over cost. Now, during the 2008 global financial collapse, we tried to, for the Right Care program in the England Department of Health, we tried to incorporate some of the Donabedian and Porterian models. But what we realized very quickly was that they were not designed for universal healthcare systems. And universal healthcare systems have two key constraints. Number one is to provide care to the entire population, and number two, to do so within a finite budget. So those numbers for England, for example, are about 57 million people, and now about 140 billion pounds. Mm-hmm. And so the question for a universal healthcare system is, how do we allocate 140 billion pounds for the maximum benefit of the 57 million people that we're accountable to? Now, that equation does not really come into play in U.S. healthcare systems. So we kind of took some of the learnings from Donabedian and Porter, and we created a customized English version of value-based healthcare, which we then termed triple value healthcare, where we have personal value, technical value, and allocative value. So personal value is value at the level of the patient. So the question there is, how do we ensure that the care that we're delivering is meeting the needs of the individual patients? Then there's technical value, which is value at the level of the intervention. So there the question is, how do we ensure that the intervention delivers the best outcomes for a given unit of resource? And then we come to allocative value, which is particular for universal healthcare systems, where we ask, how do we allocate our resources for the maximum benefit of the population that we're accountable to? Now, to put this in a more common sense way of kind of viewing this, basically, what we're trying to do is to improve patient outcomes, improve population level outcomes, and optimize resource utilization. And here, when we're talking about resources, we're talking about financial resources, but we're also talking about non-financial resources. So, for example, the use of time of both mm-hmm. clinicians and patients, the use of space within a hospital, as well as carbon. So carbon, the carbon footprint of global healthcare accounts for about 4 to 5% of global emissions. And with our net zero targets, this becomes quite an important factor that we need to look at as well.
That sounds really interesting that you had to import the kind of theory from the US healthcare system into an environment, well, into a political and economic backdrop of austerity. I think that's an interesting dynamic to enter. How familiar were you with the UK healthcare system? It's one of the UK's, I guess, greatest asset, but it still has a long way to go. Or what was that like in terms of just figuring out, was there any surprises or like things that, you know, you found difficult to manage in terms of those contexts? Because what I would consider is maybe also looking at the UK as part of the EU and like EU healthcare systems, because obviously for a very long time it ran under that. So yeah, what did you encounter on that angle?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. My I suppose maybe the starting point is when I was applying for medical schools, why did I come to the UK? And the thing is, I didn't apply to any US medical schools. I only applied to UK schools. And the reason for that was one of my late friends, he was studying medicine while I was doing my PhD. And he talked about health policy all the time and universal healthcare systems and all of that sort of stuff. And I had really no clue what he was talking about. And then he dragged me in 2007 to see Michael Moore's documentary, Sicko, where, you know, that was my first exposure to what a universal healthcare system is. Now, Michael Moore's films are obviously very, very biased, but I was very intrigued by what he was showing about the UK healthcare system and universal healthcare system generally. And, you know, then I was able to kind of more tangibly visualize what my friend was talking about. His name was Ross. In terms of, you know, what a universal healthcare system was, why it's important, etc. And then, kind of fast forward to 2008, Obama gets elected. There's all sorts of excitement about what universal healthcare will bring because that was one of his strong policy dimensions. And my idea was to, you know, kind of inspired by Sicko, work in a universal healthcare system, learn, and then go back to the States and try to help build the universal healthcare system that I felt so confident that Obama would be able to implement in the U.S. And so, yeah, that was why I decided to leave science and move to the UK to study medicine. It was because of a Michael Moore film, for better or worse. Now, in terms of the question of what I learned about the UK healthcare system, well, I came here with extremely, extremely idealistic expectations of what a universal healthcare system would be. And I was far more engaged around discussions about universal healthcare than any of my fellow classmates were. And when the Lansley reforms were announced in 2010-11, I actually read the, you know, the 350-page document that he published, because I was so kind of enamored with what a universal healthcare system was and could be. And I was gutted because it basically kind of, you know, made me think that this is going to go down the route of a U.S. healthcare system, which I was trying to escape from. And, you know, then I kind of lost my hope about what a universal healthcare system could deliver as well, because, you know, the thing was, when I came into medicine, I did not realize that there was such a stark division between healthcare and public health. I thought that, you know, in a universal healthcare system, the system is going to be incentivized and it will prioritize prevention and health promotion. In hindsight, that was probably just ignorance on my part, obviously, because I didn't realize that there was this stark division. So when I was doing the clinical rotations, when I was studying medicine at Oxford, I mean, I was kind of shocked to see these 70, 80-year-old patients coming into clinic and they're on like 15 to 20 meds. And I see this over and over and over again. They don't even know what meds they're taking. You know, they bring a bag in and they say, I'm taking the blue circle, the red triangle, you know, the green square. They have no idea what they're taking. And they're on these 18 to 20 meds. And again, because I had such high idealistic expectations, I kind of just was really disillusioned with what I was seeing. In hindsight, I think I probably should have studied public health instead of clinical medicine, because that's where more of my leaning was towards. And so I didn't leave after 2 years, actually. I mean, I deferred for a year. And during that deferment year, I did a bunch of random stuff. So I was working with coffee bean farmers in Mexico to see how we could use technology to get them fair prices. I was working with farmers in Siberia to see the black market, you know, exploring the black market for dollars and how they were eating pine nuts, for example. as a kind of a in a bartering system. My brother and I worked with the Central Bank of Tanzania to see what mobile banking, what impact that could have. Working with farmers in Senegal who were displaced by a mining company from Australia to look at the human rights violations. So yeah, I completely kind of just exploded looking at all sorts of other stuff and getting out of medicine. And at that time, I didn't really understand social determinants, but I understood that these things were important for livelihoods.
Wow, that's...
Go ahead, Umair.
Yeah, sorry. No, I was just going to say that's super duper interesting. I feel like every time I think that you've told us all of the experiences that you've had, you just bring on like 10 more. So it sounds, especially for me as a fourth year medical student, I'm very much like at the start of my journey as a doctor. And everything that you've said, I think really resonates with me because, you know, more and more these days, I feel like medical students in particular are looking into alternative routes. And honestly, for you to have been to like Tanzania, Siberia, and then all of these other amazing places, and finally settled on this on the route of social determinants of health, I think it's actually really interesting and inspiring to see how like where your journey has taken you. But in particular, on something that you said, you mentioned the Lansley reforms, and I just wondered whether you could just summarize those for our listeners.
So the Lansley reforms were reforms introduced by Andrew Lansley back in 2010-11, and they were a complete restructuring of the healthcare system. So it used to be that public health services were integrated into the NHS. Mm-hmm. With the Lansley reforms, public health then came out and became a task of local authorities. That was one. The other was some of the commissioning functions for services, which were given to, pre-Lansley, there were PCTs, the primary care trusts, and the SHAs, the strategic health authorities. And there were, I think, if I remember correctly, probably around 150, maybe 165 PCTs. And there were, around a dozen or so SHAs dotted across the country. And they were sort of focusing on strategic commissioning functions where you could optimize resource utilization at a population level. With the Lansley reforms, they wanted to devolve some of those responsibilities, and they had entities, they created entities called CCGs or clinical commissioning groups, mm-hmm. and there were about over 200 of them dotted across the country. And the power was supposed to be put into the hands of the clinicians, and so this was seen as kind of clinician-led, particularly physician-led, to be honest, commissioning of services and trying to cut out the management layer. It was fairly chaotic. To Nuzha's earlier question, which I kind of rambled on about and didn't really answer, which was my experience of UK healthcare. I think, when I left medical school and then started working in the England Department of Health, post my kind of really random set of stuff that I did on the global health front, my first insight was that there's actually four subsystems. Like the UK doesn't have one system. England has a separate system from Scotland, from Wales, and from Northern Ireland. That was probably the first insight that I gained, that they all work and function differently and separately. Because the Scotland and Wales systems, for example, don't have the purchaser-provider split that we have in England, because England, during the Thatcher reforms, took on a market-based approach to delivering healthcare, where they felt that competition would help to drive efficiencies and productivity, whereas in Scotland and Wales, they did not have that split, and they have what's called health boards. And so that was kind of the first insight. The other was just how complex commissioning for healthcare services actually is, and the dynamic between the payers and the providers, which was something that you don't really learn about in medical school because you're just focused on care delivery. And so you don't learn about these dynamics of how money flows. So understanding the money flows as well. So looking firstly at the structural differences between the different systems, that was one thing. The second was the money flows. And then the second was the power dynamics within the system between the different players. Those are probably the key things that I kind of didn't know and learned about. You know, when I left medical school and started working in the Department of Health.
Mm-hmm. And going back to something that you mentioned earlier as well, you said that 20% of health outcomes are related to access to clinical care and 80% are due to social determinants. I just wanted to double check. Did I hear that right?
Yep.
And I'm sure that for the audience listening to this, that must be really surprising. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So I think the starting point there is what your definition of health is.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Nusa. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, it just reminds me because I did a module in philosophy of medicine, and our first class was what even is health? What even is a disease? Is it just a variation of, like, it was, I don't know, it was really insightful because I feel like I'm rambling on here, but it was this idea that I had never really thought about what it means to be unhealthy, what it means to be healthy, because what we see as health might still be riddled with ailments that we just carry every day. I think, if that makes sense, like our perception of health is a social one, which is, and that is quite contextual and has changed throughout a history of what we determine as health, or like, you know, an example of health, especially with this idea of, like, obviously the humans are like very, we're not the same, everyone, there's very loads of variations within ourselves, so it can lead to any variation being considered a disease, if that makes sense. So like over medicalization, all these things that also are factored in slowly all the time as we're developing good healthcare policy, a good healthcare, and you know, obviously with a limited budget, you need to figure out how all needs are met. That was just something that for me really shaped my understanding of public health policy, because when you're determining where money goes, you need to decide who counts as unhealthy and requires healthcare, if that makes sense. So yeah, but going on to what you were saying, Anand.
Yeah, I mean, one point that I would just touch on from what you said, Nusa, in terms of, you know, finding who's unhealthy and making sure that the money goes there, you know, I think from a health promotion or population health perspective, what you'd want to do is to prevent the individuals from getting sick in the first place.
Yeah.
So rather than waiting until they get sick, mm-hmm. You are better off to some of the work that Amartya Sen has done, looking at the capability approach, for example, creating an environment that allows individuals to thrive. So that's mm-hmm. the role of social institutions. And it's these social institutions that will determine whether individuals can thrive or not. And that can be seen as kind of a another way of defining health, is whether individuals are able to do what they want to do and to contribute to society in the way that they can, based on their capabilities and based on what they want to do. And if we look at it that way, then there are a variety of social institutions that are actually necessary to enable individuals to thrive and to work to their full capabilities and capacities. So, for example, ensuring that they have a good education, ensuring that they get access to nutritious food, to clean air, to clean water, to sanitation and hygiene, to proper housing conditions, to transportation, access to jobs, social and community interactions. These are things that are necessary for individuals to be healthy. So even if you have the most fantastic healthcare system in the world, mm-hmm. They are designed for people who are sick. And so there, you've already lost the battle because you've not been able to keep your population healthy, which is why they need the healthcare system in the first place. So the ideal would be to create a system that does not even need healthcare delivery. Does that make sense? I know it sounds like a radical notion, but and poor people like poor Omer would be without a job as a physician, but that would be the ideal. It's a society that, so, you know, the other way of thinking about it is if we draw an analogy to cars and car mechanics. So the idea would be that cars are designed and maintained in such a way that you don't actually need car mechanics, because you need car mechanics when your car is not functioning properly. But if your car is designed and built well, and if it's maintained well individually by you, and you know there aren't potholes and all that sort of stuff, then you don't actually need a car mechanic, and that would be the ideal. And the same can kind of go for healthcare. So, or health in general. So if you were able to create a situation where individuals are able to look after themselves and keep themselves healthy, then you don't actually need to go to doctors and you don't need pharmaceuticals in the first place. And that's where some of these things around the social institutions and building communities or societies that allow individuals to thrive, that's where that is so important. Ensuring that they're able to get nutritious food, clean air, clean water, sanitation and hygiene, access to good education, access to jobs, and good community support.
Yeah, no, because I was just saying, I was thinking, like, but then how do you narrow down, like, how does one narrow down that problem? And if it now, if you narrow it down and then you attack on, like, just focus on one problem, does it really have that much of a ripple effect everywhere else? I mean, it probably does to some degree, but I can imagine that that kind of approach would require, it's very, very like radical. Like I don't want to say radical because that term in itself is kind of, it feels like it's othering it. But the idea that it would require a complete restructure of society in order to, like you said, the society, like the design of society needs to be in a way that that you wouldn't need to go to medical like you wouldn't need to enter the healthcare, you wouldn't need healthcare support as often as we do now, for example. So how do you navigate that? How do you as a team, and how have you seen companies navigate that, or like governments navigate that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think maybe we just look back at history, and if you've read Dickens and read any, you know, books about Victorian England, England was not such a great place. Child labor, poor air, Parliament had to go into recess during the summertime because the Thames was filled with sewage and it just smelled so bad that they were dousing their drapes in bleach so that it would keep the smell out. But over, you know, time, over decades, through the efforts of thousands of individuals, the Clean Air Act was passed, the Clean Water Act was passed, et cetera, et cetera. Housing standards improved, and life expectancy has also improved. Now, that's come with a bunch of other problems, for example, the non-communicable diseases and the lifestyle diseases. But the reason I mentioned this is for two things. You know, firstly, there's no one single intervention that can tackle all of these problems. And so I think one of the problems these days is this two things. One that I find is this reductionist approach that we can just have one solution for a problem. And then two is the desire for individual attribution, that I have done something and therefore this has made a change. This is a system problem, and therefore this the solutions have to come from the system. And there's no one individual that will be able to solve with the snap of the fingers all of the problems that exist within the system. This has to be done in collaboration between multiple entities. And there's no one individual that will have control over the entire system such that they can make this step change. The reason I mentioned the historical example is to give hope that that change is possible. Now, that change has brought us forward from the problems that we saw in Victorian England, but now new problems have come. And that is just the evolution of a system. It's going to be impossible to predict what happens. So, you know, if you look at the history of plastics as an example, the guy who created plastics was actually English. I forget his name, but he was toiling and working on this for years. And he did it with idealistic expectations that if you were able to create a substance that did not need to be replaced and did not degrade and lasted forever, then you would be able to dramatically improve society. That was his intention. when he was working on plastics, and the unintended consequences of that in the short term, all sorts of benefits were delivered by plastics, and plastics are essential for all sorts of things even now in terms of saving lives and even to a certain extent helping the environment. But the unintended consequences were something that we definitely could never have been able to predict. But that's something that we now need to adapt and change to. So, in answer to your question, firstly, I don't think any individual entity or solution will be able to solve the problems. Mm-hmm. I think that we need to work actively as a system and as a society to solve the problems that we have identified. And I think this is a never-ending process. I don't think we will ever be able to come to a solution to all of the problems because it's a non-linear system that we're working in. So it's impossible to predict and impossible to control. Who would have predicted COVID-19?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those are some really, really interesting metaphors, like, especially with the Victorian one. I feel like for the first half of what you were saying, I was thinking, this is so true. A lot of things are steeped in bureaucracy. Who do you go to? Like, just with like a personal example today, we're doing a research project for our current degree. And I was thinking, we're looking at NHS doctors and their help seeking behaviors. I wonder if we can slap on the NHS logo onto it. But then I was thinking, well, who do we ask about that? And even though it's a micro example, I think basically the structure of the NHS comes with its problems and its strengths. And one thing that I wanted to mention in particular, I guess it's more of a comment than a question. It's to do with the trip that I went on in 2018 with Ma Charity. The trip was called Journey Ma, and we were running free health camps for women. And these were all pregnant women coming from all the way around Sylhet in Bangladesh. And a lot of them were traveling many, many miles to come and have a checkup with a mixture of doctors and medical students. And for them, it was the first time that they'd ever seen a doctor throughout their pregnancy. And it was because of this mindset that they had. I guess in some ways it mirrors the idea of people being so healthy that they don't, like, I guess it mirrors the car mechanic idea. But most of the women said that it was their first health checkup because no one had ever told them otherwise. No one had ever told them that you should be getting checkups throughout your pregnancy, whether or not you're facing any problems. And basically, I guess it's just an interesting example to put out there because I guess it's a difficult balance to strike where on the one hand, we want to change their behavior so that they're able to detect any problems early on. But then on the other hand, we also do want to move towards this world where everything is good in healthcare and people as an end goal are basically not sick. So I guess it's just a comment. I don't know whether you guys have anything to add to that.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing that you bring up, Umair. You know, I think the norms within societies are different across space and time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously, if you're in the UK context, you expect a health checkup. But in the Bangladesh context, as you mentioned, they did not, because that's their norms. If you go to Dhaka, for example, I bet it would be more similar to the West than it is to Bangladesh in terms of what their expectations are. And those expectations will change over time as well. Mm-hmm. If we look at nutrition as an example in India, you know, in Orissa, for example, they used to eat millet, but because of PDS, the public distribution system, they started subsidizing rice, subsidizing in some cases and giving rice for free. Mm-hmm. There was a generational shift, and now the new generation, the grandparents still remember eating millet and they still like eating millet. Mm-hmm. But the new generation in Orissa cannot imagine a meal without rice. So, you know, that norm has now completely shifted because of their external environment. And that's not something that could have been predicted because one would have thought that, you know, well, if they ate millet before, they will continue eating millet. But now because white polished rice is subsidized, that's what people become used to, and it's just seen as the standard. Mm-hmm. And what's unfortunate is obviously millet is healthier than white polished rice, and so they're actually losing out on nutrition because of that practice. And why PDS, for example, doesn't subsidize healthier whole grains, I don't know, but you know, that will be political and power dimensions to that as well.
Yeah, so I'm asking if wondering if you did end up speaking about your better value healthcare and how that was, because I found that quite interesting in terms of, I think Omeya also agrees in terms of looking at entrepreneurship and healthcare and medicine, etc., and looking at alternative routes for medical students. A lot of Mars base were like work, well, it was, you know, a lot of their work is obviously related to healthcare, so it's particularly a society charity thing that's drawn to by medical students in particular. And you even said that, like, you, because you work so, you're so involved with healthcare, yet you said that were doing postgraduate medicine in the UK at Oxford wasn't for you. How did you come to like that realization, in terms of, was it just because you realized, how was that kind of experience? Because I'm sure moving to a whole new country and with a set goal in mind, and for that to kind of change, like, have you always been in the mindset that if something's not working for you, you kind of just change it or you stick it out? Like, how do you approach that?
Yeah, I take, let's see, how do I structure my answer to make it useful? Firstly, I take a scientific approach to how I deal with just occurrences in my life. So as a scientist, I kind of expect things to not work. like when you're on the lab bench, when you initially just start in the lab, and this I remember, like my first experience doing proper lab work, I read the protocol. I'm like, okay, yeah, this is easy. I'll just do it. And it took me 6 months to get that damn experiment to work. And it was extremely simple. It was just like 7 or 8 steps. And it was because, you know, I didn't have the hands. And I take kind of an empirical approach since then, as through my training as a scientist, where firstly, I constantly reflect on what I've done and what has quote unquote worked or not worked. And I also go into new things, expecting mistakes. And you know, my first scientific mentor, you know, he told me 4 weeks in the library will save you 6 months on the bench. And you know, what he was alluding to was you spend 4 weeks in the library and you read what other people have done, you reflect on what you've done, you learn from their mistakes, you learn from your mistakes, and then you go to the bench and you make new mistakes. Because you don't want to repeat the stuff that's already been done, but you also don't want to stagnate. You want to push the boundaries. And so that's kind of the approach that I take is, you know, this, even going to medicine and coming to a new country was for me an experiment. And I didn't have, you know, grandiose views of what I, you know, what I would become. Mm-hmm. I was kind of taking it one step at a time and then, you know, doing something, reevaluating it, see what I liked, see what I didn't like, et cetera, et cetera. So that was the approach that I took. And then when I left medical school and did all these random things, it was a similar approach. Mm-hmm. I didn't get paid for any of it. I was just doing it voluntarily because I was interested and I wanted to experiment because I had never done anything in these domains before. So I just got in touch with people. I went to talks at Oxford. I was still living here. And it was a very vibrant and rich environment. And I just said, you know, I'd be interested in working with you. If I could help, just let me know. And then, you know, these projects just came up like that. Mm-hmm. And it was similar when I started working in the Department of Health. None of the stuff that I did was by design, if that makes sense. I didn't intentionally say, I'm going to start a company, I'm going to work in a company, blah, blah, blah. It was more very opportunistic and just kind of seeing where I was going and then seeing how comfortable I was, what I liked, what I didn't like. In terms of the company, I mean, to start off, I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
Everybody starts a company says, I've always heard that they don't really know what that's going on at the beginning.
I had absolutely no clue. But I was lucky, and you know, the guy that I was working with, who's from the England Department of Health, Sir Muir Gray, is very patient, and we had a great support network of mentors, business mentors. And you know, from that, we were able to get some products. I learned how to do sales, how to do a needs assessment, to look at the company financials, and you know, basically get some basic management expertise under my belt. Make sure that the amount of money coming in was more than the money going out. So very basic, simple things. So the business experience was, I would say, transformational for me because it got me to think in a completely different way. Because in a business environment, you're much, much more, you have to be much more careful. And your thinking process and your priorities are different from when you're a medical student or a medic or an academic. Mm-hmm. It's a completely different way of thinking and working. Because now you have other people that are dependent on you in terms of the company. So we had, you know, 8-9 employees. And so the question there was, how do we ensure that we get enough money that everybody keeps their jobs? And then how do we ensure that we get enough money that we get some margin that will allow us to grow as a business? Mm-hmm. So, that was, and again, that was all empirical as well. I had no idea what I was doing, but I was, you know, careful in terms of not making too many mistakes. And if we did make mistakes, to kind of do a dissection and a forensic analysis of any mistakes that we did make to ensure that we learned from it, and then to ensure that we didn't repeat it. But also being sure that we were pushing the boundaries of what we were able to do, because otherwise we wouldn't grow as a business and we would stagnate.
So, but then, like, this is another thing that I'm always curious about when it comes to healthcare, like more healthcare companies or like these kind of businesses, essentially. It's like, how do you balance research with actual service? Because in these respect, like as an academic, you obviously recognize there's so much research and nuance to everything. And how do you deal with the kind of, not perfectionism, but tailoring something that you know and are confident in that it doesn't do a disservice to all the knowledge that you do have? Does that make sense? Like, how do you manage that? How do you, you know, and also like within the confines of the budget that you do have, like how do you navigate that?
Yeah, so the prioritization is quite important. The thing about a business is this Herbert Simon concept of satisficing. So it's a combination of basically letting not the best be the enemy of the good. So that perfection that you mentioned as a characteristic of academia, to a certain extent, is necessary in a business environment because it keeps you competitive and keeps you honest and ensures that you deliver the best products and services to your clients, which is your main goal. So from a business perspective, you don't exist unless somebody wants to buy what you're selling. Mm-hmm. So it's not about what you want to sell, it's about what the client wants to buy. And so you need to ensure that you're delivering your client the services that they need and want, and that they're satisfied with what you have delivered. So from that perspective, that's the starting point for any product or solution that you design within a company or corporate environment. It has to be based on the client. So it's not based on what you creatively want to discover or, you know, blah, blah, blah. It has to be based on what the client wants. Now, there are counter examples to this, you know, that you might think are against this notion. For example, Steve Jobs and the creation of the iPhone, and the Henry Ford and the Model T, where, you know, he said, you know, if I asked people what they wanted, they would say a faster horse.
How do you figure out, especially again in the healthcare dynamic, what it is that the customer wants? Like, how do you determine that? You are working with a particular framework in that, you know, there's a certain framework that you're working in that is very different to innovation technology, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So for us, it was value-based healthcare where, you know, again, going back to the basic definition is improving patient outcomes, population level outcomes, and optimizing resource utilization. So for our client base, what we knew was that those are three things that they've been trying to do for decades. And, you know, based on the numbers, what we were able to see is that, you know, in some cases, they're not able to achieve it. And so then what we bring to market is a different way of thinking about how they structure their services so that they are actually able to deliver on those three objectives, because that's something that they all want to deliver on. So that was a starting point for us in terms of value-based healthcare. If we go back to the Model T example, you know, and the faster horses, that is the product where, if, you know, he asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. But behind that, is the core need of the individual, which is, you know, what Clayton Christensen would describe, what is the job to be done, which in that case is getting from point A to point B faster. That is the need of the individual on the ground. And what Ford was able to do was to create a mechanism whereby that could be achieved in a more efficient way compared to a horse. And for Jobs, he would have started off with something similar in terms of the iPhone. So what do people need? Well, they need to communicate with one another via phones. They want to take, you know, photographs. They want to browse the internet. These are all the needs of the individual. And all of the technologies that he integrated into the iPhone, the first iPhone, already existed. I mean, there were a few tweaks that he did here and there, but touchscreens existed, mobile phones existed, cameras on phones existed. He basically packaged them all up into one seamless, elegant package, which hadn't been created before, but nobody in the market would have been able to visualize because they were only thinking about them as separate products. So this is the sort of mindset that you need to have is, you know, firstly is understanding what the need is of the individuals on the ground. And that's the core need, not having a faster horse or, you know, a more efficient Palm Pilot plus BlackBerry plus digital camera. But what are the actual needs? And then figuring out a way of efficiently and effectively delivering based on those needs of the individuals in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And that's what needs to drive your innovation and the creativity. And once you've created something, from a business perspective, once you've created something, the key thing for a business is productive efficiency. So you don't want to keep reinventing the wheel and new products and services because the investment that you have to make there will detract from your ability to make, you know, profit because the profit is necessary for you to actually grow your business. So what you want to do is to design a product or service based on the needs in the marketplace and then basically just sell the hell out of it and improve the productive efficiency such that if it took you X resources to deliver that service at time T equals zero, find a mechanism whereby at time T equals one, you're able to deliver it with 0.75X resources. So 25% less resource, but the same outcome and the same satisfaction from the client. Which means that the amount that you've charged, you can either decrease the price or increase your profit margin. That's a different way of thinking. So you're still innovating, but you're innovating in a different way. You're still delivering the same outcomes, but you're trying to improve the productive efficiency. So this is still, it's still a way of researching, but it's not that core creativity that you oftentimes find in research where you're addressing a question that's never been answered before.
So we've been following some of the work that you've been doing very closely, and we know that you've been focusing more recently on syndemics. And we just wanted to know, would you be able to tell us a little bit more about what that is and the significance of them right now?
Yeah, great question, Umair. So if we look at systemic events or I guess not catastrophes, but just... tough times. You know, the most recent systemic challenge that we've had was the 2008 global financial collapse, obviously discounting COVID. And with the 2008 global financial collapse, what we learned, and this has been seen in other catastrophic situations as well in other countries and other contexts, particularly in low and middle income countries, is that when you have this sort of event, you will have a decrease in living standards and difficulties for all strata of society, both the haves and the have-nots. But the haves will be able to recover more quickly compared to the have-nots. And so what you'll get is what's termed as a syndemic, which is you may have had an epidemic, say, of non-communicable diseases and lifestyle-related diseases in the lower socioeconomic demographics. And you'll see this across contexts, both, you know, global north, global south, rich countries, poor countries. And when you get one of these systemic events, which causes difficulty for the entire system, the haves will recover more quickly than the have-nots, because in addition to the sort of epidemics that they were facing before, they now have the pandemic on top of whatever they're facing before. And it will be more difficult for them to recover. And what you'll end up with is a greater gap between the haves and the have-nots. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that trend over and over again for these sort of systemic catastrophes. We're seeing that again with COVID-19 as well. So mm-hmm. the have-nots are suffering more than the haves, mm-hmm. and it's going to be more difficult for them to recover as well. And so from the perspective of where the interventions need to be within the system, it probably has to be for those demographics that don't have as many means to actually recover from the COVID-19 lockdown and pandemic. So the key intervention modality that we've been looking at is social prescribing as a means of actually addressing social determinants of health to prevent these individuals from getting even worse or going down further. Mm-hmm. And that ties into some of the work that Wilkinson and Pickett did in their book called The Spirit Level, which demonstrated, I think convincingly, but some others in the community think that some of their evidence was biased and may not be representative. But I mean, you guys can read it for yourselves and make the judgment yourself. I kind of believe it and buy into it. I thought the arguments that they proposed were sound. They demonstrate that a wider gap between the haves and the have-nots are bad for society as a whole. So not only is it bad for the have-nots, it's also bad for the haves as well, because it reduces the standards within society. So from that perspective, just looking at social solidarity and the population health more generally for the entire society, I think it's important that we try to reduce the prospects of this endemic and therefore address the social needs of these individuals who are more vulnerable pre-pandemic and mm-hmm. are likely to be more vulnerable post-pandemic. Mm-hmm.
And when you say pandemic, it sounds like that can refer to something that's either a virus or just some sort of problem that affects a population as a whole. Is that correct?
Well, no. For a pandemic, I would use the medical definition, which is mm-hmm. Sort of an infectious disease. That's why I was using this term of a catastrophic event, which I would term the global financial collapse. Mm-hmm. But it did make the have-nots dip down further than the haves, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. And so
that,
from a social determinant perspective, compounded on the difficulties that those individuals were already facing, which increased the gap between the haves and the have-nots, and also made life more difficult for the have-nots mm-hmm. relative to the haves.
Okay. So I think you've touched on some really, really interesting stuff today so far. And unfortunately, I wish this conversation didn't have to end so soon. But our final question to you is, a lot of the listeners today are very much going to be at different stages in their journey in life. Most of them will have a common interest in global health, but a lot of them may be undecided in what exactly it is that they want to do. So I guess our final question to you is, what advice would you give to anyone listening today? And that can be advice on anything in terms of their journey through global health, their journey through medicine, or any of the millions of different experiences that you have.
Yeah, that's a tough question. I don't know if I can give an answer that would work for everyone. Mm-hmm. But I'll just say what's kind of worked for me in my career so far. And if it works for you, I think that's fantastic. I think the bottom line I would say is try to find and do something that you enjoy and mm-hmm. that makes you feel like you have purpose in life. And the way I do that is by constantly asking questions mm-hmm. About the work that I'm doing, and then also to myself. So this process of introspection and taking a few steps back, getting some quiet time, walking in a park, and just asking yourself, am I doing what actually feels like gives me purpose in life? And this kind of goes to some of the stuff that Clayton Christensen talks about in his book, How Will You Measure Your Life? Mm-hmm. And, it's not looking at how much money you've made or how many papers you've written, but, actually going deep down into what makes you tick and what makes you feel like you have purpose in life. So I think defining that first and then working backwards. And defining that, I think, is not an easy task. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, again, for me is taking an empirical approach to trying things and not making assumptions about what I will like or will not like. And so, I think asking yourself questions, trying different things, talking to different people and keeping an open mind, these have been things that have worked for me. But as a general thing, I would just say, you know, try to ensure that you're able to find and pursue something that makes you feel like you have purpose.
That sounds brilliant. And it sounds some great advice for all of our audiences and for ourselves too, because it's quite universal. But yeah, just like Umeya said, that it's unfortunate that this conversation has to come to a close. But if you guys listening are interested in the content that we've been producing and talking about and the conversations we've had, please do follow us on all our other platforms for Mars the Podcast, on Instagram and Twitter. We're going to be producing lots of new episodes with Umeya and I, and also our other co-host Arifa. Thank you for taking the time to actually sit down and talk with us, and I really appreciate it.
No, thank you guys, it was great. It was great to chat with you guys, and thanks for the great thought-provoking questions. I'll now have something more to reflect on as well in terms of the work that you're doing in Ma.
Yeah, thanks for the thought-provoking answers.
Yeah, thanks, giving us more to go away and think about. But yeah, we hope you all enjoyed this episode, and we will see you all next time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.